What is going on, y'all? And thanks again so much for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And I'm not in here alone. My fizzy water drinking buddy is sitting over here next to me as we sweat and enjoy our afternoon. Kyle Wilson.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in Skeleton Studios trying to figure out how to
finally
turn this light
warm.
On. It's finally getting warm. I'm trying to turn this light on. Oh, there it goes.
Jeez. Okay.
That seems to help. And I'm enjoying this fizzy water here. I have a new one from Liquid Death. This one is called Mango Chainsaw.
Oh. Hey, look, our heart goes out to everybody involved in the storms. It has been a rough few weeks. People have been getting hammered, losing all kinds of stuff. Like, man, it's been rough. East Texas got it good.
Yeah,
like,
Georgia.
It has been, yes.
Arkansas got hit pretty hard.
Arkansas got it. Well, man, it's just been rough and wild here. But, hey, look, we're into the summer down here. Kyle and I have been out. I got into the chiggers. We were picking wild plums out at the lease, and they've about eaten me up. I don't know what we call them chiggers. I think they're called, are they like red bugs?
Isn't
that what they're at? I don't know. But boy, I'm one of those people. Mosquitoes don't really bother me. Like, they don't really land on me that much.
Man, they do me.
They do my wife, right? Like, they land on her all the time. The same thing is, but they don't on me. And like ticks. If you go out there, I don't get ticks. Do you get them?
Not very rarely.
Yeah, I very rarely ever, but these chiggers, they are attracted to me. Man, it is crazy.
I got them all over me when we were walking around in that high, tall grass when we were walking around the other day.
In the back. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's where I got, because I got the home. I had the same experience.
Man.
Anywhere there's clothes that's tight, like elastic waistbands and stuff, they love to get in there.
It's like somebody wrote War and Peace in Braille on my legs.
Yeah, my legs
that's
are pretty
chewed. That's how bad it
up.
Is. Yeah, it's pretty awful.
They always, and I don't know if there's really anything you could put off on, I guess, before you go. But it's one of those things, I never think about it till later that evening, I'm all scratched. I'm like, man, because I'm dumb.
I will tell you what we used to do, and I don't know how safe this is, and I don't recommend this to anybody, but this is something that me and some of my work partners used to do. When you knew you were going to be out in that stuff, we would go to the cheap dollar stores in your area, and we would buy flea collars for cats.
Mm-hmm.
And you put them around around the ankles on your boots.
And sense.
We never had any problem with anything. There was nothing. Now, of course, you didn't touch them, and it's not like these were slip-on boots, right? So you just tied them around there and went on with it.
I thought you were going to say you dusted yourself like in Seven Dust or something.
Oh, no. You know what? You've probably had that stuff all over helping your granddad around in the garden and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if it's good, bad, or indifferent, but I'm sure it's probably shortened us a little bit. Our lives are a little shorter for inhaling Seven Dust or something.
Sure. You're not going to live forever.
Yeah,
don't worry about it. It doesn't matter. I've got some interesting stories for y'all today.
What do you got
for
me?
I've got stuff concerning Dog Man. I got a possible leprechaun sighting.
Wait a minute.
Alien abduction. And then, of course, an unnamable beast from the UK. So I got an action-packed episode for you.
Well, I've got something for you because I know how much you love the wild headlines. There has been, here on Texas property, a blue-eyed, hairless feline cryptid spotted.
So like a chupacabra.
Like a catman.
Oh, man.
In Katmandu, baby.
A tabaxi.
A tabaxi, if you will. This is in Rusk County, here in Texas. Said this resident confronted a large, hairless, blue-eyed feline. All right? Now, this goes on to say, a few years ago, my wife and I were living near Laneville, Texas, which is located in Rusk County on Farm to Market Road 225. My wife loves gardens, and we've always had a chicken pen. Our adult children enjoy the garden produce and, of course, the fresh eggs from our hens. We've lived this way for many years, after we moved here in 1981, and we had no intention of ever going back to the city. Now, this incident that I'm writing about happened in 2015, and it signaled the end of our chicken business. Each morning, I have to walk down to the chicken pen, and it was about 150 feet behind our house. Now, after I fed the chickens and checked their water, I headed back to the house to eat breakfast. Now, I've got guns, but I never carried one around on our own property. Now, at the time, we had a terrier who went everywhere we did. She had never shown any inclination to be afraid of anything, but on this day, I was in the middle of my chores when the terrier stopped dead still. Now, she was fixed on something beyond the tree line behind the chicken pen, and the hair on her neck and back stood straight up. She was frozen in place and didn't move a single muscle. I shifted my gaze to the tree line, and what I saw caught my breath. I knew I was looking at something I had never seen before. This thing apparently had been walking just outside the tree line, and it stopped when we did. It seemed to be the size of a wolf. Its head was light gray, and there wasn't a single hair on its body. Its rear legs made it appear as though it could easily walk on all fours or stand upright like a man. The tail was the same length as its body, and from where I stood, it looked like a dog until it turned, revealing a head that looked more like a feline than a canine, with similar short, pointed ears. Now, the eyes were something unworldly. They were bright blue and bore into us for about 15 seconds, showing no sign of fear. It then turned and walked into the woods and out of sight. I tried to make sense of what I had just witnessed as I hurried and tossed the chicken feed into the pen, and I realized that the terrier had already hightailed it back to the house ahead of me. Now, over breakfast, I told my wife about the encounter, and from that day onward, the terrier would not go near the chicken pen unless she was with me. Even then, she stayed behind me, always watching the woods, and, well, I did too. See, it's strange how random things can suddenly make sense once you see a connection. A few weeks later, a feral dog got into the pen and was trying to kill a chicken. I was going to gather eggs, and ever since the strange encounter that day, I'd begun carrying a rifle with me. Well, I shot the dog, and I got a shovel, and I dug a hole behind the pen. The feral dog was the size of a large collie and must have weighed 80 pounds or so. I had to drag the carcass to the hole and roll it in it. After burying the dog and securing the pen, I went back to the house, and, well, that was the end of it, or so we thought. 2 days later, while feeding the chickens, I noticed something odd behind the pen. I walked around to take a look, and what I found was a hole 2 feet across, right where I had buried the dog, and the carcass was gone. There were no drag marks, none whatsoever, and it was big enough to pull the body up and out of the dirt and carry it off without leaving a trail. I searched all over the back of our property and never found anything that would suggest some sort of scavenger was at work. Now my wife and I were the only ones who knew what I had buried back there. The next morning, when I went to feed the chickens, it looked like a crime scene. They were all dead. They were all headless, and the remains were scattered about the pen. The rooster had been tossed 20 foot from the ground into the top of a persimmon tree. Oddly enough, given the scale of the carnage, there was not a single drop of blood anywhere. The gate was latched, and there was no hole in the fence or signs of something that gained entry by digging under the fence. But the killer had left some evidence behind. There were footprints and deep gouges made by 3 long claws that were estimated to be 2.5 inches long. I drove over to my neighbor's house and asked him to have a look at the tracks. He was a hunter who was born and raised in this area, but he was even stumped. He suggested that we call a friend of his who was a constable and another longtime resident. He looked at the tracks and examined the dead chickens, and after he noticed the dead rooster dangling in the tree, he warned us not to go out at night without a gun. We decided not to replace the chickens. Not long after that incident, we moved to another location. We just didn't want to cross paths with whatever was lurking around the property.
Wow. See, I think it's a chupacabra.
Well, it kind of sounds like it now, right?
But right. I mean, that's the, you know, it's a possible misidentification of a unknown creature. And I know that a lot of people talk about the blue-eyed dogs, those blue dogs.
Blue dogs.
They almost looks like a Weimaraner in color.
Yeah.
Because it's the alleged chupacabra.
Have you ever heard stories? I'm sitting here thinking about this when I was reading it. I've never heard a story of anyone seeing a mountain lion with mange, like a hairless mountain lion, right?
I never have either, but it's definitely possible. Why wouldn't it be?
Well, I'm assuming cats could go hairless. I've seen just regular old barn cats that have it, right?
There's species of cats that are hairless, like Sphinx.
Yeah, of course, they wouldn't live long out there in the cold or whatever if they were all hairless. You got to keep those cats under a heat lamp. But I don't know. It'd be odd to see. I mean, I don't know. I'm just trying to rationalize what that thing could possibly have been, but it just sounds like something awful. And we also know here in Texas, there are 3-toed tracks of Sasquatch.
That's true.
Right?
Yep.
So
here in Louisiana,
yeah,
are sightings, and then there are
possible Rougarou tracks.
Sightings of things that they claim are 3-toed hominoids, you know? I don't know.
Pretty
check
wild.
Check this one out. This is speaking of Dog Man and the Rougarou and stuff. Check this out. It says, "Hey guys, I really enjoy your show and thought that I would send in a story my grandfather John told me. In 1940, he volunteered for active duty and was later shipped off to Camp Stewart, Georgia. He had graduated high school in New York City the year before and thought that the U.S. would be fighting in the war eventually, so he signed up before he was even drafted. At the time, he was part of an anti-aircraft training unit that was housed in large tents. Camp Stewart, now Fort Stewart, was a fairly new facility, and much of it was under construction. Most of the tents were in or near an area that was densely forested. I don't know how many guys were in the tent with him, but he was friends with another guy from New York City named Pete. They hadn't been there long when stories about weird creatures in the woods started to circulate among the soldiers. One of the rumors was that a few soldiers had been attacked by an unknown beast within the camp. There wasn't a lot said, and no one, he believes, either witnessed either one of the attacks. One early morning, Grandpa John and Pete, along with other soldiers, were transporting garbage to an area north of the camp. He said that there was a large ditch where all the refuse was dumped. It was hauled in large barrels, and which were then emptied one by one. He was in the lead truck as they pulled up to the dump area. They noticed a very large dog on the back edge of the ditch, which looked to be digging through the trash. They were commenting that the dog may have been a wolf because it was huge. While they were talking among themselves, the dog stood up on its two back legs and looked directly at them.
Nope.
After a few seconds, it turned and dropped to four legs and ran off into the woods. They were alarmed and considered leaving, but there were armed personnel on the patrol. They then wondered why armed soldiers needed to guard a garbage dump. Maybe this is why. They quickly got their work done because they wanted to leave as soon as possible. Grandpa John said that he later had a conversation with one of the guys who had spent time guarding the garbage dump. According to that guy, the higher-ups were aware of the large dogs, which he believed to be wolves. He said that there were other similar beasts in the area and that they were ordered to shoot to kill if they had the opportunity. He admitted he witnessed one of those wolves stand up on two legs and walk also, though he didn't say why he failed to shoot at it. Now, Grandpa John was later injured during training, but after 2 years, he was cleared for assignment and served in the U.S. Army in Europe. He said that over the years, he talked to other vets who had trained at Fort Stewart. A few of them were aware of the attacks and that it probably occurred on more than just one occasion. I've read about dogman sightings and heard you guys talk about them on your podcast. I wonder if the Fort Stewart beasts may have been the same type of creatures. I'd be interested if others have had similar experiences or heard of these attacks. Thanks for all you do, Jack. Wow, that's a crazy story that your grandpa told you. Thank you for his service.
That's awesome. You know what? I wonder the same thing. I wonder how many of those things have happened or encounters have happened there that nobody spoke about.
Yeah. And apparently the guy in charge of the base was aware of it. And they just told all the guys on patrol to shoot to kill. And, you know, it always makes me think. Me and Luke went back and watched The Dog Soldiers. And that is a movie, if you haven't seen it, is really good. I think it's on Stars right now. I think that's where we watched it. But anyways, it's like soldiers and they have this run in with these dog men, right? Kind of reminds me of that. Or at least that's what I'm picturing when I'm reading this guy's stories. Like, here they are at Fort Stewart. They're doing the basic stuff. You know, they're privates. They're taking the trash out. And next thing you know, there's a bunch of these
a monster.
giant wolves walking around on 2 feet. Maybe it's a family of werewolves that lived in that area at the time. Very, very creepy.
You don't make enough money as a private to have to deal with werewolves.
No one does.
I'm just going to go ahead and say, oh, there's some people do, but not as a private. You don't. They need to give you better guns and more ammunition to deal with werewolves. Speaking of military, I got one for you, Brad.
Okay.
It says the names in the following account are changed to avoid criminal prosecution. Both I and the man who told me of the incident are holders of now inactive top secret clearances issued by the Don CAF, which is the Department of Navy Central Adjunction Facility. Now, I don't know if the details of the incident are still classified. This is why I've changed the names. I apologize in advance for the cryptic nature of the story. However, I've known this man, and I'll call him Jim, and served in combat with him for many years. I have and will stake my life on his integrity. People have been misled to believe that these are animals, so it's okay to kill them. So, some time ago, Jim was sent on a tad temporary additional duty to a unit in Alaska. Most of the time there was spent on field daying at this or the location, sitting around and passing or scuttlebutting rumors about the nature of their purpose there. The official title is simply Security Force Training and was conducted on target acquisition field navigation, and winter survival alert drills were called mostly daily. So outside all the time, in the snow, out in the cold, getting after it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Says Jim and his platoon responded to the alert as always, only this time the truck they had boarded started pulling out. He said they rode for 15 to 20 minutes to get out of there into the middle of a huge valley, at which point they were told to follow an officer and a civilian guide. Now, he and the others walked quickly at first for about a mile and then were told to be quiet. They were also told to check their weapons. Standard M16A4s, and one guy had an M40 and a 7.62 by 5.1 millimeter bolt rifle. Little bolt action there. Hey, they were told that they were there to kill an animal that was a threat to the compound and local residences. Jim told me that he had been on edge until that point because he didn't know what they were up against, but that a hunt for a bear or something was a relief. They spread out in a skirmish line and moved forward slowly and quietly with the guide about 20 yards in front of them. They had advanced that way about 150 yards when the guide stopped. They were just inside a tree line on the edge of a large meadow. As the line got to the guide, Jim said he saw what looked like a dark brown bear about another 50 yards into the meadow. The officer pointed to the bear and indicated that there was their target. At that point, he and the others cycled the bolts on their rifles and took aim. That's when the bear stood up, only it wasn't a bear. He said it was about 6 foot tall with wide, flat shoulders, not the sloping shoulders of a bear, and the legs were far too long to be a bear. Its head was humped, and it had a long arm, and it turned to its head and it said, looked at him. So the way it's kind of roughly written is its long arm swung and it turned around, okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At that point, nobody fired a shot. The thing grabs something off the ground and starts running away. That's when he saw the second one, smaller in his words, maybe 4 or 5 foot tall, following the big one. And they were too quick. So sounds like maybe a mother and a cub.
Yeah, possibly.
That says the officer in charge hollered, shoot, and we opened fire. The first to go down was the smaller one. The big one stopped while still under fire and went back to the small one, dropped to one knee, and let out what Jim described as a cry of a mother over her dying child. I saw the hair on his arm stand up when he said, I kid you not. The rest of the story he told me with his head down, unable to look me in the eyes. He said, we stopped firing when the mother cried out, but the officer ordered us to kill it. So we resumed fire. The mother refused to leave the downed child and took what he said was around 90 to 100 more rounds, and she finally went down. No one moved forward, but they stopped firing and reloaded. He said, we held our positions for, I don't know, about 10 or more minutes. That's when the officer started to walk towards it. The guy told him, stay there and wait and give us some time to be sure it was dead. About an hour passed with no one talking, and he said we couldn't even look at each other. My gut was churning the whole time, and I wanted to throw up. Finally, the guide and the officer walked to the bodies and confirmed they were dead. The rest of the platoon were not allowed to view the bodies, but were ordered back to the truck. On the way back to the compound, he saw other military vehicles headed towards the site, but they weren't from his compound. He said, I don't know where they came from. I mean, we were the only military in the area. Upon returning to the compound, he and the rest of the platoon were debriefed one by one and told not to talk to anyone about the mission under threat of a life sentence in Leavenworth. Both Jim and I are retired and both our wives have passed, so we don't have much to lose. I took a couple of shots of Jack Daniels and some other war stories to get this one, but I swear every word is true. Jim doesn't lie, neither do I, and I'll have words with any man who said that this didn't happen. People need to know these are not animals. They are just as human as you or me. I don't know how they came to be, and I don't care. I just want people to know. I hope you can help me make that happen. Feel free to talk about this and tell this story with anyone. Jim won't talk to anyone, so I'll try to talk for him. So the whole thing goes on. It says that Jim, this fellow Mike here believes that Jim's ashamed of what he's done.
Yeah, man, don't kill Bigfoot.
Right? Now, how bad is that?
Bigfoot's nice.
So my question is this. with the military groups and all that, how many of them, like we've talked about whenever Mount St. Helens had gone down, all that, how many of them, how many of this has this time happened before where guys have been sent out to have to do something like that? And maybe they were no danger to anyone. They just wanted them out of there. I don't know.
I believe that they firmly know that they exist and they kind of have to cover it up. Just same with the UFOs and the technology and stuff. I mean, they know, they're aware of it.
They kind of have to, I guess. Yeah.
I guess they kind of have to. Check this out. This is pretty cool. This is a picture of a small child that says that this is a picture of me from 1956. I was around 5 or 6 years old. Now take a look in this picture because it's relevant to the story I'm about to tell you. Now I know a few listeners out there, you can't see it. It's just a picture of a small boy in like a winter's jacket. And he says, notice my age of innocence. Notice the season of the year. Notice the clothing I'm wearing. This picture was taken in the backyard of the house we were renting on Main Street in Commerce, Oklahoma. A small two-bedroom house that needed to accommodate my mom, dad, my two sisters, and I, not to mention our dog, Bubbles. This took place in, March of 1957, Cam. It says it all began on a winter's day close to the end of the season. The winter had been bitterly cold, and I was unable to go outdoors and play. Dad had put up a swing set in the yard to the east of the house the previous summer. Not only did it have two swings, but it also included a sliding board and a teeter-totter. I could scarcely wait for the weather to warm up so I could take advantage of that fun just waiting to happen. Now, during this time, Mom worked at home, mostly babysitting and taking in some ironing. She hated to iron, but she did it for the sake of the family. I remember many days watching her iron her way through a stack of laundry, a stack literally taller than me. She did the ironing in the living room, the only room big enough for the job. It was on such a morning's day that the cold of winter subsided, and Mom said I could go out and play on the swing set as long as I promised to bundle up. She said it would take at least 5 hours for her to finish the ironing. Then she had to wash dishes and do some house cleaning. Joy unspeakable. I couldn't get my coat on fast enough. Rushing out the front door with that childlike desire to play, it was impossible to hold myself back. A bright light was in the way of me and the swing set. It was an odd, intensely bright light in front of the swing set, shining down from the sky like a spotlight hitting the ground directly in front of me. For me, 1956 was a time of innocence. I was young and had none to very little exposure to stories about bright lights coming down from the sky, alien encounters, UFOs, or anything. The incident I'm now continuing to tell you happened. It was not a dream or a daydream. It was not my imagination from watching TV or playing Superman or not some elaborate hoax I've conceived just to entertain you. This is the absolute truth. It did happen. It is vivid in my mind. It is burned into my mind forever. I've told very few people about my story for fear of ridicule. After all, even my mother never believed me. Upon hearing the story, on the day it had happened, she said, "Oh, you were just daydreaming. You playing like you were Superman. It really didn't happen." Believe me or not, here it goes. As I approached the light, it was blindingly bright. It was coming from the sky as far as up as I could see. It was in the shape of a spotlight, wide enough to swallow me completely if I were to step into it. My anticipation of playing on the swings ignored the light in that direction, in the direct path of my goal. Running forward, I ran into the light. The light enveloped me with a brilliance so intense it was overwhelming. I felt awestruck as well as frightened. The light captured me like an animal in a trap. I could move my arms, but I could not escape from the light. It held me. There was an upward force on my body. It felt like a magnet pulling on me. I felt weightless. Looking uncomprehendingly around me, I began to rise off the ground. The light somehow was pulling me through its corridor towards the sky. Has something gone dreadfully wrong with my mind? I was thinking. Am I hallucinating? No, it was actually happening. I was rising in the air. It was not a vivid dream. It was genuine. It was happening, trust me. Looking down, I could see all of the yard, then the roof of the house. Rising further, I could see the block my house was on. Then I could see the entire town of Commerce, all of the streets and the houses. It was as if I were viewing the town from an airplane. higher and higher, becoming more terrorized with each passing moment. Out of the light, I heard a voice. More like I felt the voice through every fiber of my being. The voice reminds me of the earthquake we experienced in November of 2011. The earthquake is the first one I've ever experienced. It rumbled like thunder through the house, shaking the walls and vibrating the floor. Lasting only 20 seconds, it left me with the feeling of an awesome power passing through the house. I felt the earthquake in my entire body as the earth shook with the unnerving vibrations. As powerful as the voice felt, it was a soothing voice, a calming voice. At the time, I thought it was God speaking to me. "Do not be afraid," the voice softly spoke. "Why are you taking me? Where are you taking me?" I apprehensively asked. "To take you from the troubles to come," is all the voice replied. "No, I don't want to go," I answered. "You are chosen. We are here to take you." I said, "I want my mom. I don't want to go. Don't take me. I'm afraid," I pleaded. "It is your choice. We will not force you. Please consider carefully your decision. We are here to help you escape things to come, to show you wonders yet unseen." I said, "No, man, send me back." I spoke with fear. "Take off your coat and let it drop to the earth as a sign to us you have chosen to stay with your family and this world full of its corruption." I quickly took off my coat and I let it fall down the tunnel of light, still connecting me with my yard. The coat drifted slowly. When it hit the ground, I found myself standing on the back porch of our house. "How did I get on the back porch?" I asked myself, confused. "What happened to the light?" It was gone. The back porch was screened in and had a door leading in from the steps. I pushed on the door to go out. The door was locked from the inside. "How did I get in here if the door is locked?" I asked myself. "Maybe through the door that leads into the kitchen," I thought. Trying that door, it was locked too. Locked, and I could not enter the house. I don't understand this. How did I get on the porch with both doors being locked? Unlocking the screen door, I left the porch. I went around the house, past the swing set, to the front door. I burst through the front door as white as a sheet and barely able to talk, looking for my mom to tell her what had just happened to me. She was not in the living room. Moments ago, she was. She had been ironing a stack of clothes. The clothes had all been ironed and neatly folded. The ironing board had been put away. The dishes were washed. The house had been cleaned. Then I noticed it was beginning to get dark. But how could that be? It was in the morning. How could all the clothes already be ironed, the dishes washed, the house cleaned? I'd just been in the house a minute ago. Where on earth did the day go? A minute ago to me was over 9 hours of time. I lost over 9 hours of time. Where was I? Why couldn't I remember living through the 9 hours? Only a minute had passed. Mom was in her bedroom when I found her. I told her about the light and the voice in the light, how I had dropped my coat through the tunnel of light because I didn't want to leave her. I told her how I found myself on the back porch, but I had not entered the porch on my own. She dismissed all of it as a daydream. She said, "Oh, you're just playing Superman." None of what I said had happened. She said it was impossible. She tried to reason with me. "You could not have been gone for over 9 hours without me knowing about it. I would have checked on you." She would have checked on me. I had no answer for that. "Other people would have seen the light. No one reported it but you." I couldn't answer to that either. I had no proof. Then I remembered, "What about my coat? I'm not wearing it. Where is it?" We walked outside by the swing set and found my coat laying on the ground, where I had dropped it through the light. "See?" I said, "there it is. You took it off when you were playing and left it by the swing set." "No, Mom. I dropped it down through the light. You were playing make-believe and convinced yourself that it was real." I couldn't convince her. To this very day, she tells me it was all just a dream. I still have no proof. I 100% believe it happened. I had an opportunity to go on a journey to somewhere, but I blew it. I was so afraid. I wonder what my life would have been like if I had left my coat on. Thanks for sharing all the stories on your show. I find them very interesting. Archie. Wow. So you were abducted by aliens is what it sounds like.
100%.
What a crazy, What a crazy recollection.
Wow.
Right? You know, it's just strange how some of these things happen. And, of course, this was 1957, so it was a different time where kids were told to go outside and you could be gone all day long. And my parents never checked on me.
No.
If they did, I wasn't aware of it.
Yeah.
It's just a different time. So I think it's a pretty terrifying yet very, very cool
that
story.
That missing time stuff always wigs me out, right?
Yeah.
Like that idea is terrible.
Well, speaking of scary, let's take a break. And when we get back from the break, I'm going to be talking about the nameless thing of Berkeley Square. Stay with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
This unknown monstrosity, this bizarre killer from beyond the grave, is one of the strangest stories I've ever come across. Some claim that it is a phantom, a spirit, a demon, while others claim that it's some type of mutant cephalopod which lurks in the filthy labyrinth of the London sewer system. Or perhaps just a clever story concocted by simple crooks to keep any onlookers away. It is a truly disturbing tale, and if real, one that will haunt your very dreams. Considered by most paranormal experts to fit more accurately into the realm of haunting, the nameless thing of Berkeley Square has left behind tantalizing shreds of evidence. And, unfortunately, more than one corpse, which suggests that the ghosts which inhabits the fourth floor, although some claim it's the second floor, of number 50, Berkeley Square, in what has been referred to as the most haunted house in London, may not really be a case of spiritual infestation at all, but rather a semi-aquatic, predatory, cryptid phenomenon. Although no one is exactly sure when the first encounter with this beast occurred, the first known account of the thing dates as far back as the early 1840s, when a 20-year-old, Sir Robert Warboys, came across strange rumors surrounding the notorious Berkeley Square address while drinking late one night in a tavern in London's Holborn district. Evidently, Warboys was a man not prone to superstitious beliefs. He had heard of the stories before, about the terrible hauntings of number 50, Berkeley Square, but dismissed them as pure speculation and urban myth. Now, Warboys' barroom buddies wholeheartedly disagreed with his assessment, and in what can only assume was an effort to knock him down a peg or two, challenged the young noble to spend the night in the haunted fourth floor room. Warboys, with what was no doubt the heady rush of alcohol-fueled confidence, raised his pitcher of ale skyward and announced to his cohorts, I wholeheartedly accept your preposterous, harebrained challenge, and went ahead with it. Sir Robert then proceeded to the allegedly haunted dwelling, where he insisted the landlord allow him to spend the night in the ghost-filled quarters. After some debate and some money, the landlord reluctantly agreed to Warboy's request, but only with the caveat that the young man be armed with a pistol, and that at the first sign of anything even remotely out of the ordinary, he would yank the cord that was attached to a bell in the landlord's room below. Warboys apparently scoffed at the notion, but agreed to the terms. As the clock chimed midnight, Warboys settled down at a table to await the thing's arrival. The landlord, with what one must assume was a great lack of enthusiasm, left his temporary tenant alone in the dreaded room, save for his pistol and a single candle. But it wouldn't be long before the two would meet again. As Sir Robert sat in the dimly lit room, he concentrated on any sounds that might be resonating from the dark corners, or perhaps any adjoining rooms. He sat there, just listening. He could hear his own heartbeat in the cold, dark room. Less than an hour following the landlord's departure, at precisely 45 minutes past the hour, the proprietor was startled from an unfit slumber by the violent clanging of the bell adjacent to his bed. Before he even had time to clear his thoughts and react, a gunshot echoed from above his room. With a burst of adrenaline, the landlord leapt from his bed and climbed the stairs at a rapid pace. When he arrived at the door to the notorious room, he pushed it open to reveal a sight which he would never forget. The room was apparently unchanged, except for the notable fact that Sir Robert had left his perch at the table and was now wedged in the corner of the room. The still-smoking pistol was caught in the white-knuckled grip of his fear-contorted corpse. He was dead. In the very short time the landlord spent in the room, he noted that Warboy's lips were peeled back from his clenched teeth in a grimace of horror, and his eyes seemed to be literally bulging from his skull. The landlord followed Sir Robert's gaze to a lone bullet hole in the opposite wall and speculated that Warboys had fired at the infamous thing, but for reasons he could not surmise, the bullet had no effect on the beast. There can be no doubt that 50 Berkeley Square can boast a horrific array of paranormal encounters, ranging from strange sounds reported by neighbors to the confirmed death of guests and domestic servants. But there is one confrontation which has become the benchmark of this legend. Just 3 years following the horrific death of Sir Robert Warboys, 50 Berkeley Square became the site of yet another gruesome demise. Although the details of this narrative have varied in minor degrees from one retelling to another, the core of this account has always remained the same. In 1943, two sailors from Portsmouth, Robert Martin and Edward Blunden, after having squandered all of their lodging funds on an evening of drinking and debauchery, were in badly need of some place to sleep. Well, after strolling around the streets of London in the wee hours of the morning, seeking a place to lay their heads, they finally came upon what looked like an abandoned building. It was. It was 50 Berkeley Square, now abandoned and in need of some badly needed repair. Well, they went around testing all of the doors, but they were all locked. They decided not to do too much damage and worked out a plan to only break the basement window and then let themselves in for some much needed sleep. So, that's what they did. And not long afterwards, they discovered that the lower level of the house was uncomfortably damp, not to mention rat-infested. The sailors migrated upwards, finally settling down in the now notorious room. London, presumably the more sober of the two, expressed the anxiety he felt upon entering the room. He claimed that he felt a presence, but these fears were promptly dismissed by his shipmate, who used his rifle to prop open a window to allow for a breeze. He then built a fire in the long unused hearth with bits of broken furniture and rotting floorboards. It wasn't long before the two men were huddled in the relative warmth of the floor, fast asleep. Sometime after midnight, Blunden awoke to see the door to the room creaking open. Little by little, a sliver of dim grayish light crept across the wooden floor. Too terrified to move, Blunden managed to wake his accomplice.
Robert! Robert! Wake up! Wake up, damn it!
The two men sat up as they heard a strange, moist, scraping sound slowly approaching them. Later, Martin claimed that it sounded as if something were dragging itself across the floor. Suddenly, the terrified men leapt to their feet and came face to face with something they couldn't describe. Something otherworldly. Some hideous monstrosity. The creature undulated between the sailors and what was their only hope for escape, the open door. Then, just as the trembling Blunden began to reach toward the rifle, which was still wedged in the window frame, the creature suddenly lunged forward, wrapping itself around the young sailor's throat. Seizing the opportunity, the panic-stricken Martin ran from the house, screaming for help. Soon enough, he stumbled upon a patrolling police officer.
"Officer! Officer! Please help me! My friend! He's got my friend!"
Although skeptical of the young sailor's frenzied tale, and no doubt attributing it to the almost overwhelming stench of alcohol which permeated his uniform, the officer dutifully followed Martin back to Berkeley Square. According to the account, Martin and the officer ran up the stairs, but found no sign of Blunden in the room. Martin reclaimed his rifle, and as the two men continued to search the house, their efforts seemed to prove fruitless, however, until the men entered the basement and were greeted to a ghastly image that would haunt them for the remainder of their lives. Lying at the base of the stairs in Berkeley Square's moist, rock-walled cellar was Blunden's dismembered corpse. His body lay in a mangled heap, with his head wrenched viciously to the side. The officer reported that the young man's eyes, much like those of Sir Robert Warboys, were wide with unimaginable horror. This appalling tale, like so many other legends of this ilk, has also been recounted with a decidedly more phantasmal twist. The most notable variation in this retelling is the description of the thing as a shadowy, man-like figure with a deformed face and body that burst in on the sailors and proceeded to strangle Blunden with cold, misty-looking hands. Yet another discrepancy has Blunden perishing not in the basement, but being hurled from the window and impaled on a spike on the wrought iron fence that surround Berkeley Square. It's these inconsistencies that have led many investigators to file this case under the paranormal banner, assuming that it's just another ghost story. But there is intriguing evidence to suggest that this may be genuine, albeit exceedingly bizarre, a real material entity. While these shocking encounters leave more questions as to the thing's identity than answers, there are other alleged eyewitness accounts which can help us to paint a more complete picture of this creature. Some have described it as an amorphous being, formless and slimy, which emits a gruesome sloppy noise when it moves, while others insist that it is a dark, shapeless, spectral form, which can be described as a collection of shadows that attacks its victims with clawed feet and razor-sharp bird-like talons. Though accounts conflict regarding the actual shape and size of the beast, at least one eyewitness has included tentacles in his description of this creature, likening the monster to a small, vicious, deformed octopus, which pulls itself across the floor, leaving a viscous trail in its wake. This description has led some researchers to speculate that the thing may actually be some kind of mutated freshwater octopi or an unknown amphibious marine animal that managed to migrate from the Thames into London's vast subterranean sewer system, where it is able to infiltrate the Berkeley Square home via the plumbing. It kind of reminds me of the giant fluke man from one of the original X-Files episodes. It can also be speculated that this beast was looking to feed on the ample rat population that also dwelt in the house when it accidentally stumbled across the more substantial prey of the drunken sailors. In the 1920s, eminent psychic investigator Harry Price revealed a large number of data regarding earlier encounters with the thing. While poring over scads of newspaper articles, he came across a story from 1790 that claimed that 50 Berkeley Square once housed the headquarters for a crew of counterfeiters. Harry Price speculated that the counterfeiters had concocted the spooky tale to frighten off curious onlookers and to provide a spectral cover for the noisy processes that accompanied their illicit nocturnal activities. Price also managed to turn up another 1840 account of bizarre noises, including bells, loud footsteps, and heavy dragging sounds emanating from the house that were so rambunctious that a small group of courageous neighbors felt obliged to search the house to no avail. He also came across an 1870 article published in the magazine Notes and Queries by W.E. Howlett, which stated,
"The mystery of Berkeley Square still remains a mystery. The story of the haunted house in Mayfair can be summed up in a few words. The house contains at least one room of which the atmosphere is supernaturally fatal to body and mind. A girl saw, heard, and felt such horror in it that she went mad and never recovered sanity, at least not enough to tell how or why. A gentleman, a disbeliever in ghosts, dared to sleep in number 50, was found a corpse in the middle of the floor after frantically ringing for help in vain. Rumor suggests other cases of the same kind, all ending in death, madness, or both as a result of sleeping or trying to sleep in that room. The very party walls of the house, when touched, are found saturated with electric horror. It is uninhabited save by an elderly man and his wife, who act as caretakers. But even these have no access to the room. This is kept locked, the key being in the hands of a mysterious and seemingly nameless person who comes to the house once every 6 months, locks up the elderly couple in the basement, and then unlocks the room and occupies himself in it for hours. Price also noted that while 50 Berkeley Square was located on a piece of real estate wedged in one of London's most enviable districts, it had remained vacant for inexplicably long stretches of time. His personal conclusion of the whole affair was that a particularly nasty poltergeist had been active at number 50 in the 1840s, but doubted that the thing was still at large.
Since 1853, the ground floor of the house on Berkeley Square has played host to an antique bookshop known as Mags Brothers. Although there have been no reported sightings of the creature in the 20th century, it has been noted that employees of the bookshop are not allowed to go up to the top floor. They say a police notice hangs on the wall inside the house that was put up in the 1950s. It states that the top floor of the house is not to be used, not even for storage. No one is exactly sure why. Although, in a case like this, it is difficult to separate truth from legend. One likely reason is that there have been no recent encounters with the beast, and is the fact that if this creature indeed has oceanic roots, it has, in all likelihood, returned to the fathomless depths of the sea. Or more chillingly, it and its offspring may still be lurking in the labyrinth of century-old tunnels which weave their way beneath the city of London, feeding on rats, and just waiting, to crawl back up from the sewer one day to claim more human victims.
We're back with expanded perspectives. Crazy stories.
Yeah.
You know, it's folklore, legends, you know, I don't know, but it's, I love these strange, impossible like creatures that are said to exist or be seen in an area. And I know it's all probably make believe, but it's still fun to think about and daydream. It makes a good campfire story. So save that. Very, very cool. I mentioned in the intro that I had a possible leprechaun sighting, so I'm going to get to that.
Here we go.
Before we get out of there, it says, hello, Kyle and Cam. A couple of weeks ago, you guys read a listener story involving a possible leprechaun sighting. Well, I think I had one too. One day in the late 80s, 1988 to be precise, I was on my way to an appointment in London's southeast area. I was traveling through Oxford Circus to get to the line which would take me to my station. In Oxford Circus subway, there are at least three levels, which are hubs with various lines that run through them, and I was on the second level heading to my eastbound train. I passed through the main hub of that level, which had escalators going up to the street level and a series of other tunnels branching off of it. As I approached the main chamber, I was overcome by wonder and curiosity because there was a sound coming from there, and I could not really comprehend what was making it. It was musical, and yet at the same time, it was not. The sound was very enchanting, is the only way I can describe it. I was becoming more and more curious by the second to see what was making the sound. Entering the main chamber en route to the other tunnel, I looked over to the source, and this is what I saw. In the few seconds it took to cross that chamber, there were two very long escalators going up and down to the street level, and in the center, between the two, stood a little man. Upon first glance, I noted that he was cherubic in stature, with stocky arms and legs and a face with rosy cheeks. And even at my location, a few feet away, I could see his eyes were extremely blue, otherworldly in color, and were twinkling. His lips were red, and he had a white mustache and beard, and his hair was blonde, silverish in color. These details were striking in relation to the others that were in evidence. In his hands, he held a delicate silver flute from which that sound, or music, if that's what you want to call it, was emanating from. It was enchanting in the sense that one's mind would try to resolve it to a melody or a harmony, and then it would dance away to become something else. His dress was very much what you would imagine where you would see what a leprechaun would be wearing in real life. Drab in color with beige, earth green, and khaki brown tones, with boots that looked made of felt and the like, and even a small felt khaki green hat on his head with a feather in it. Okay, so he could have been dressed in a costume, and that would have been the end of my curiosity were it not for what was happening around him. Crowds of people going up and down those escalators on both sides were reaching into their pockets and wallets and dropping money into his bag. Yes, he had a bag, which was a plain old plastic shopping bag, but it was filled to overflow with coins. This bag was bulging on all sides with coins and paper money, and it was overflowing through the handles, part two, onto the floor. That was what caught my attention, was the fact that the people who were tossing in the money weren't even looking at him. It was like they were in a trance. He was looking at me the whole time, watching me see what was going on, and I must have registered some astonished awareness to him on my face because he smiled in the middle of all this playing and gave me a wink and a nod. He continued to play on, that eerie music filling the hall and ears and my mind. And the people continued on like sleepwalkers, not paying any attention, just digging into their pockets and dropping their money into his bag. I continued on my connecting tunnel. Not a few feet down the tunnel, I encountered a young man playing on an electric guitar with an amplifier who was being completely drowned out by the eerie sounds coming from the adjoining chamber. I looked into his guitar case as I went by and saw that he had only a few coins in there. I looked at his face, and he gave me a look that bespoke amazement and irritation that his music should be drowned out by that otherworldly one coming from the main hall. Feeling badly for him, I dropped a pound coin into his case and continued on my slightly befuddled way by what I had just seen and experienced. I later shared this with some friends that I had seen what I thought was a real leprechaun. I told them my story. They laughed at me and thought I lost my marbles. Then about a week or so later, one of my friends came up to me at work, very excited. She said that she had just seen my leprechaun in the same place, in the exact same situation as I described. Everything was the same, down to the people in a trance dropping money into his bag. She said when she had seen him, her mouth dropped open in amazement as she realized I had been telling it exactly as it was. And he, too, had looked over to her during that moment of astonishment and had given her a wink and a nod. We never saw or heard of him again after that, so perhaps he got what he needed. Thanks for all you do, Lotus. So this person saw a leprechaun putting people into a trance, and they're just pouring money into his
bag. A little
bag.
Leprechaun busker down there in yeah. England.
And he had everybody in the room hypnotized with this magic silvery flute.
That's crazy.
Right? What a bizarre story.
Maybe it's just a regular busker. He's just figured out a really, really good way, but it doesn't sound like that. It sounds, that's,
I love stories.
That's of some leprechauns. Of that Harry Potter stuff y'all got going on over there is what that is.
I love stories of leprechauns. I want them to be real.
They are real, bro.
I hope so.
It's Faye. Look, Lon knows how to do us right. Sends us great stuff, hooks us up with crazy stuff, and he knows exactly how to reel me in like we've talked about.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
This took place in Pennsylvania, right? I don't know why Pennsylvania's got some, man, a stack of wild stuff that goes on up there. But when I read this, I knew you were going to like it, Brett. Ram-horned man encountered on Devil's Road near Brandywine State Park.
I love centaurs. I love,
the goat man, the satyr.
Yeah, satyrs. I love all that
stuff. You played a satyr too, didn't you?
No, I wanted to.
As the allergies kill me. Listen to this. It says, I grew up in Delaware County, Pennsylvania, which is right on the border of Pennsylvania and Delaware. That's weird. I never would have guessed that in Delaware County. Huh? It's crazy. Anyway, there's a state park close by, the Brandywine State Park, where the famous battle was fought during the Revolutionary War. A small part of that park is known as Beaver Valley. And from satanic cults to a town full of little people, the number of conspiracies surrounding the place can lead you down quite a rabbit hole. Some people use it as a shortcut when Naaman's Road was backed up, but never at night and never on any of the roads that supposedly harbored evil spirits. Well, one night after getting out of work around 11 o'clock, I was feeling adventurous. I called my friend Alan to see if he wanted to check out the place with me. He agreed, and within a half hour, I'd picked him up and we were on our way. Now, the park is large and there are multiple roads leading into it and out of it. Navigating it can be a little confusing, and cell phone service stinks, so GPS apps don't always work. So Alan said he knew his way around, but I didn't really believe him. It didn't matter since I didn't have anything else to do this late at night. Anyway, so driving through the outskirts of the park was a little creepy. A few people lived back there, but there were no streetlights at all. The only illumination we had was being cast by my car's headlights. The roads rose and fell and curved often, sometimes sharply, so I had to give driving my full attention. So eventually we found what we were looking for, Devil's Road, or Cassart Road. It's called this because of the way the trees grow along the road and that they all curve away from the road as if they're trying to uproot and escape something that's coming from deeper within the forest. I've heard about it plenty of times, but actually seeing it, well, that's a very different experience. There are rumors of cults practicing satanic rituals here in the woods. Recalling the rumors and seeing the trees, I was starting to feel like I had my fill of weirdness for the night. I was thinking about getting through as fast as I could and getting back out onto one of the larger roads. Then Alan let out a surprised yelp from the passenger seat. He told me that he was looking in the forest beside the car and that he had seen something running along before disappearing into the brush. Now, he didn't know what it was, but he said it could have been a deer or something. Well, I kept driving. I figured out we were about 3/4 of the way through when I rounded another sharp curve and had to slam on my brakes. I had almost hit it right in front of the car. About 10 feet away, shining in the headlights, stood a completely naked man. Now, it was January and the temperatures have been dropping into the 30s lately, so the guy should have been freezing. He was tall and thin man, filthy, with long, matted brown hair and an unkempt beard. He stood staring into the windshield, not shivering or showing any signs of being exposed to the cold. His breath wasn't even fogging. Alan and I sat silently, both too shocked to say anything. And honestly, I was extremely scared. It started to get colder, even inside the car, and I started to shiver. And then a moment later, I was shivering uncontrollably. Alan was doing the same thing right next to me. I began coming around to what was happening and reached down to put the car in reverse. Something was telling me to just get the hell out of there and leave the naked guy standing in the road. But the car wouldn't move. I was pressing the gas and the engine wouldn't even rev. I wasn't even sure that the car was on anymore. Now my head was beginning to feel foggy. Strange thoughts and ideas kept forming in my head, but they were slipping away before they could take root. I vaguely remember Alan reciting something that sounded like a Bible verse. As far as I know, Alan isn't particularly religious, and I found it strange that he could quote passages from the Bible. Then the man started to move, slowly stepping backward, methodically, foot after foot, still staring right into the windshield at me and Alan. He backed away completely out of view of the headlights, and then all that was in front of us was a stretch of empty road. I started warming up immediately, and the fogginess began drifting away. I then saw the eyes ahead on the road coming from where the man had disappeared. It was a pair of narrowed red orbs hovering about 8 feet off the ground or off the road surface. They were moving slowly up and down as if attached to something moving. A creature slowly appeared given the light. It had the shape and size of a horse, but the head was a cross between a ram and a man, with curling horns that jutted from both sides and wisps of dark fur. The nose and the mouth were unmistakably human. The fogginess returned tenfold, and I couldn't keep my eyes open any longer. I woke up to banging on my window next to my head. I had an excruciating headache, and there was a light being shown in my face. It was a police officer. We had come to in a small clearing off the roundabout that was 3 miles away from where we had been. Alan had passed out as well, and neither of us could recall anything. The police officer asked us a lot of questions and even searched the car for drugs and gave me a breathalyzer test. I told him everything, and by the time we were done, he must have just thought we were some kind of weird loonies, and he just wanted to get rid of us. We hadn't really done anything illegal, at least I didn't think so he just let us go. I don't know how we ended up in the clearing, and I don't remember what happened after we saw the thing. I mean, bits and pieces are coming back to me slowly. I'm trying to think of all kinds of excuses. Maybe something was in the car or up with my car and we got a non-lethal dose of carbon monoxide or something. I don't know. I can't explain it. Since that night, there are random moments where I feel a sense of overwhelming terror, like something horrible is only seconds away from happening for some reason. I can't get it out of my head, and I have no idea why. Thanks, Dave.
Wow. I love the stories of satyrs and stuff like that. It's Faye, right?
Like, how crazy. Yeah, how crazy is that? Is this thing, first the guy, sounds 100% sounds Faye, right?
Yeah.
You meet this naked guy there that seems, but what was that? This ram-headed, like, centaur?
It could be a demon.
Could be a demon, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. So, there's y'all some more creepy, crazy stuff that makes some unnerving feelings. If any of y'all ever been to Brandywine and know any of that or seen anything crazy, email us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Send it to us. I would like to hear y'all stories about more of the Brandywine.
Absolutely, send us a story. But if you'd like to tell the stories to us in person, we're going to be appearing soon. Don't forget, in Fort Worth, Texas, on Friday, September 1st through Sunday, September 3rd, is the second annual Dogman Cryptid Conference. There's going to be lots of big guests there, like Josh Turner, Ken Gerhard, Lyle Blackburn, Nick Redfern, Christopher Garantano, David Weatherly, and much, much more.
Kyle Filson.
Me and Cam are going to be there. That's right. It's going to be very cool. You can go to, I'll put links in the show notes where you can go buy tickets. And it's going to be neat. It's going to be at the White Settlement Convention Center. There's even VIP tickets available where if you get those, you get an exclusive meet and greet catered dinner with all the speakers. You get to talk with them and stuff. And also you get front row preferred seating at the event. You'll receive a special swag bag with varied merch. Probably get some Expanded Perspective stickers in there.
I hope so.
And you can meet me and Cam. You can tell us your stories one-on-one. We're going to be there with microphones and cameras. So maybe even
kissing hands and shaking babies.
That's exactly what we're going to be doing. So don't miss out. It's very cool. You can go to evenbright.com and search Second Annual Dogman Cryptid Conference, or you can just go to the show notes, and I'll put links to it all in there. Let's not forget about our wonderful sponsor, Lumi Labs.
Just go to microdose.com and use the code EXPANDED. You're going to get free shipping and 30% off your first order.
Absolutely. If you have a show, a story, I almost said show. If you have a show or a story you'd like to share with me and Cam.
If you videoed something crazy.
You can email the show, expandedperspectives@yahoo.com, or you can call the hotline, 888-393-2783. That's about all the time we have for this episode. Till next time, folks, I'm Kyle. He's Cam.
Peace, y'all.